This is a CBC podcast. Get your daily dose of Canadian history from the CBC Digital Archives. Complete with clips from radio and television, find out what happened in the On This Day section at cbc.ca/archives.
Hello, I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas. Today we return to the world of cancer screening with the second of our two-part series, You Are Pre-Diseased, by health researcher Alan Castles. Most people don't realize there's a controversy among medical professionals about cancer screening. There are downsides. Besides the false positives, there's overdiagnosis. Humans are full of abnormalities, and the screening tests find more cancer than would ever go on to hurt you. In spite of being heavily advertised, pushed by public health agencies, and suggested by our doctors, a number of popular screening programs have not been subject to gold standard style evidence. In other words, we don't know if they save people's lives or not, but they get done, and done a lot. Today's program starts as Alan Castles discovers an ad in his hometown newspaper. It offers him a way to possibly save his life.
If you live like I do, on an island, whichever direction you walk, you'll eventually reach water. Just down the street from my house is the Pacific Ocean, and when you go down to the beach at night and look across the Strait of Juan de Fuca, you see the lights of Port Angeles in Washington State blinking in the distance. Just recently, a yellow one-page flyer plopped out of my morning newspaper. It's an ad for a private, mobile medical imaging facility which is coming to Port Angeles. The headline reads, "A body scan can save your life." The flyer is asking people to make their appointments for lung or heart or full body scans. When I call up the toll-free number, a nice lady on the end of the line tells me about the wonders of their GE sonogram, a type of ultrasound that she says can find malignancies, cysts, gallstones, enlarged prostates, heart blockages, leaky heart valves, and so on. You can get individual organs scanned or order up the full package, the full meal deal, for only $500. Lots of Canadians come down here to get their scans, she tells me cheerfully. Ads like this are popping up all over the place. Newspapers and television are full of stories about screening, most of them in favor of it. Some private insurance plans cover annual body scans, or they're offered as bonuses for executives. There's no question that medical imaging has become a staple of healthcare in the 21st century. It's time I learned more about it. And what better way than to go to the annual conference of the Radiological Society of North America, which, as it turns out, is the world's biggest medical meeting.
So the, kind of like your United States, your actual state borders are is your CT, the weather is your PET, you fuse them together. Now you can see where the actual cancer is in the body.
Every year, about 60,000 delegates and marketers descend on McCormick Place on the shores of Lake Michigan in Chicago for the annual conference of the Radiological Society of North America. The RSNA holds the world's biggest medical meeting in the world's biggest convention center, with exhibit halls that cover as much space as 45 football fields. This place literally defies superlatives.
CT units, or what are the main things that we're highlighting on this system that are the differentiating factors?
So the main thing in PETs, the most important parameter in PET imaging, is sensitivity. Sensitivity means as the photons are coming out of the patient, it's how many photons you're collecting. The
more photons introduces some very significant breakthroughs in overall image quality for a CT scanner. So specifically, we've taken the resolution, the spatial resolution of CT, and improved that by 40%.
I'm here to meet not just the specialists who are at the leading edge of imaging from around the world, but to schmooze with the vendors, the 20,000 people from literally hundreds of companies who make up the global sales force of the highest of the high tech, selling CT scanners and MRI machines and x-rays of all shapes, sizes, and chemical compositions. CT, or computed tomography, uses X-rays. MRI, or magnetic resonance imaging, uses radio waves and very powerful magnets, while PET, or positron emission tomography, highlights an area of interest that has been injected with a radioactive material, known as a tracer. Some of these machines are as big as dump trucks. Other types of scanners, such as ultrasound scanners, might be small enough to fit into a briefcase. The modern art of medical imaging involves nearly every imaginable discipline under the sun, from medicine to photography to computer science to nuclear physics, all to better refine and sharpen the pictures of disease.
It's got a full capability of neural applications, cardiac applications, and it's a great system because, again, it's faster than anyone that we've ever had before. It's intensely easier to use because of the ergonomical advancements, the automated protocols that are on the system now. The detachable tables allow for less patient waiting time, the ability to set up a patient on the outside, bring them in, get them scanned, and very easily, you know, bring them in and out. And those are the biggest functions.
This place blows my mind. But I'm wondering, why the heck is a conference on radiology so huge? What makes 60,000 people fly in from around the world to attend scientific lectures amid gleaming new gadgets and well-groomed salespeople? Is it because radiology touches so many medical specialties? Possibly, but let's face it, it's just as much because big boys like their large toys. This place is a Cirque du Soleil of medical magic.
On the 750 HD, you will be able to tune the X-ray spectrum that's used to image the patient in order to target the specific diseases.
They're both 3T and 1.5T systems that are simply powerful and powerfully simple. Now, since virtually everything about these products is new, we're not quite sure where to start. So we're going to leave that up to you all. We want you to tell us which of these topics interest you the most. Where should we start today? With advanced clinical capabilities, streamlined workflow, or cutting-edge research? Press 1, 2, or 3 now. You have 5 seconds. You're going to tell us which topic to talk about in which order. And you chose to talk about what first? All right, advanced clinical capabilities. All right, well, all 3 subjects are...
If you're a big boy and you've got a chance to work the joystick on some of the highest octane medical toys in the world, why wouldn't you come here? And man, if those medical toys can save lives, you're at the final frontier.
The vision of the Department for MR is to put forth the leading edge, to work with industry and with our own scientific community here to advance the clinical applications and to make important discoveries that either directly or indirectly lead to improvements in health. 3D imaging capabilities are going to be very important.
Turnaround times, post-processing times all leads to many minutes of delay throughout the day. So anything that minimizes our delays as technologists and streamlines our processes really has a great impact on the efficiency of our department on a daily basis.
In an oasis of calm above the hype of the conference floor, I meet Dr. Brian Lentil. He's a past president of the Radiological Society of North America. Although he's edging into retirement, Dr. Lentil still comes to the annual meeting from his home in Victoria to see old friends and get caught up on the newest advances in radiology.
Radiology has enjoyed a phenomenal period of growth in the last 20 or 30 years, driven in part by the applications of computing information technology to imaging, but also in the use of the energies that we use to make images. I mean, this whole field started in 1895 with the use of X-rays. But now we use sound energy, we use electromagnetic radiation in MR, we use optical imaging, we use still X-rays for CT, we use gamma rays in nuclear medicine and in PET. So that there's been a twofold growth, and it has become, frankly, central to medicine now, in a way that it never was, certainly when I began my career in radiology.
Dr. Lentil is very enthusiastic about the growth of radiology in just over a century. At the same time, he cautions against using the technology without the science to back it up.
you really can't speak effectively about any screening tests unless you look at the downside as well as the upside. The upside is obvious, that if you catch cancer early in a disease with a long latent period, then there's some potential for improved outcomes. But, you know, the downside has really got to be measured accurately and factored into the equation before you embark on these programs without thought. I mean, these tests have not only got false positive outcomes possible, but false negative ones too. So
right.
you can make policies and you can indicate that we should be reliant on evidence before we enter into medical practices, but, you know, there are still some people who will push the envelope. And you know, I'm not imputing any motives here. I mean, they may be doing it for very good reasons. They may be doing it purely as an economic enterprise.
On the HD platform is the ability to do all applications at 50% less.
Another prominent radiologist I expect to find here is Dr. Claudia Henschke, the chief of the chest imaging division of the Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York City. She's been running clinical trials on CT screening for lung cancer for many years. The evidence isn't in yet, but Dr. Henschke believes that high-risk people, such as smokers and former smokers, will benefit from being screened for lung cancers. This is not exactly the same as whole population screening, but it does mean scans for large populations.
We looked at those very terrible death rates for lung cancer, where almost everybody dies of it, and dies of it within a very short time, a year and a half. And we felt that with low-dose CT, we could do something. So I am very enthusiastic about the research that we're doing, because I have very long-term survivors, and they'd come and say to me, I wouldn't have been able to see my grandchild even born or growing up, and I've done all of these things in the past 10 years where I would have been normally dead. So that keeps you motivated, because that really means you're saving lives, and that's the goal of any screening program.
Even though Dr. Henschke is enthusiastic about lung cancer screening, she recognizes its limitations.
Any screening program, let's say breast cancer, there are about as many new breast cancers each year in the U.S. as lung cancers, even a little bit more. So a screening program really each year only picks up a very small number of cancers, 2 to 3 per 1,000 that are screened. And if your risk population is higher, like in lung cancer, then you might get up to 5 or 6 per year that you would identify. So that's the problem with screening. That's why it's a big ticket item for any healthcare system, because you screen a lot of people to find a few at risk.
Because of the fact that there's no evidence to back up the use of CT scans as screening tools, the Radiological Society is one of many groups who discourage the use of this technology for screening healthy people. On the convention floor, I hear from the salespeople that CT is not used for screening.
Then, certainly CT has that capability. No CT screening done today for cancer.
It's not cleared for. We can't do it at all.
No, right? that's not what CT does.
But ads like this one in my hand suggest that people get full body scans. Someone wants to use CT as a screening tool. I take my confusion to Dr. Norton Hadler, a physician, medical educator, and author of 11 books, including The Last Well Person, How to Stay Well Despite the Healthcare System. He's got an obvious passion for connecting with ordinary people. Can he give me some hints on when and under what conditions a person should seek out a full body scan as preventative healthcare?
There's nothing wrong with the notion of screening. Absolutely nothing wrong with it. It carries with it an imperative. If we can do something good by screening, now remember, we're not talking about diagnosis, we're talking about screening. There's no reason to have this procedure, test, or screening event done to you except it came about on a particular day in the year. It's not to answer your symptom complaint. Well, there's nothing wrong with screening, as with three provisos. You never want to screen if the test is inaccurate. You never want to screen for a condition that is not important. And you never want to screen for a condition about which you can do nothing of substance for the individual when you find the condition. Those are the three major provisos, and everybody ought to ask those three questions whenever they are offered a screening modality.
The test has to be accurate, the condition must be significant, and you need to be able to do something about it when you find it. So how do these imaging technologies stand up to those demands?
You know, we all have these wonderful textbooks from going back hundreds of years on the normal human anatomy. And we tend to teach it, and most Americans think there is a pristine, normal human anatomy, and there really is. But as I like to teach, if there's anybody who's 40 years old or older who has a normal spine, that's distinctly abnormal. That many, many people have tiny little, not even growths, but dense collections of cells and other structures in their lungs. We can find them in the liver. We can find them in the kidney. There are normal abnormalities that have been studied and have essentially no prognostic significance. There are many of us who have these little changes all in various parts of our body. So now you have to ask of the screening test, how good are you as a screening test at sorting out these normal abnormalities, which I really don't care about because they don't mean anything to me and they're not going to change my life or my quality of life or my length of life, from those things that I wish you could find early, such as the early bad breast cancer, the early bad lung cancer, the early bad what have you. And the answer is the imaging tests are not very good at being able to tell you that the little thing they found is a good thing or a bad thing. So when you look at the data of the accuracy of these total body screening events to find not an abnormality, but an abnormality that you want found because finding it means something important to you in terms of disease, life expectancy, the accuracy is horrendous, just horrendous. For every bad thing that's found, many, many, many hundreds of abnormalities that you don't care about will be found.
So full-body scans don't stand up to the first test, the accuracy test. The images may be too good, and they may see too much to be useful as screening tests. I learn around the conference that the abnormalities we don't care about are called incidentalomas. It's a made-up word, of course, but it refers to the things they find when they're looking for something else. And often, even without intending it, a diagnostic test for one thing can become a screening test for another. This is apparently common enough that two South African technologists I meet ask if I've ever been vomited on. Pardon me? It's an acronym, says one of them. VOMIT, Victim of Medical Imaging Technology. No, I haven't been vomited on, at least not yet. But I have read what happened to William Cassarella when he went in for a scan of his colon. Dr. William Cassarella is a professor of radiology at Emory University in Atlanta. He is one of the 60,000 or so people at the conference, but what probably makes him unique is that he's experienced screening from both sides of the gurney. After a lifetime spent screening and diagnosing people with disease, Dr. Cassarella himself underwent a simple CT screening test for colon cancer. The 64-slice CT scanner found all kinds of potential abnormalities on several of the organs surrounding his colon.
The CT scan, of course, takes slices through the entire body, so it isn't limited to just the colon. And therefore, you do see the kidneys, the liver, the lung, base of the lungs, etc. So you can find unexpected, fortuitous findings that could be important, but could also be very misleading. And in my case, there were multiple lesions.
So what happened in your case?
Well, we had a kidney mass that turned out to be a cyst, but then we had to actually interrogate the kidney with another scan using contrast, et cetera, to prove that it was a benign cyst. And then there were a couple of other areas of that were questionable in the liver, and those wound up undergoing a liver biopsy, which proved them to be not significant. And the most difficult thing were a couple of masses at the base of the lung, which were difficult to tell what they are. And that's usually the case in lung lesions, that it's hard to be 100% sure whether this is a malignancy, a metastatic problem from another site, or just a residual of an old infection, a little granuloma, something that has no significance. And the usual way that you do that is to follow them with more CT scans to see if they grow or see if they change their character and look more like malignancies. And in this case, the decision was made to, well, let's just biopsy those and take those out because they look pretty suspicious. And so I had to go through a thoracotomy.
What's a thoracotomy?
Thoracotomy is when you open the chest and take out the lung, or you fix the heart or something like that. So it's a kind of a big deal if you have to do, you know, lung surgery, essentially is what that means. You do a thoracotomy, you take out a piece of the lung, which they did, and it turned out to be benign also. But it was a lot of activity that was precipitated by a screening test.
So you became a patient. They were looking at your colon, but they found these masses on
right.
on your kidney, your liver, and your lungs.
Right. None of which were significant, but they were not definitively diagnosed purely on the basis of the CT scan. Everything was done perfectly, but, you know, it took a couple of weeks of recovery from the thoracotomy, and it's a pretty big cost and moderate amount of pain and discomfort. And a lot of anxiety, which an equivocal screening test always produces in the patient.
I wanted Dr. Cassarella to tell me whether or not he personally would have had the initial scan if he'd known what he was going to go through. But he didn't answer the question directly.
Well, I mean, I think that what I experienced and what I, you know, was brought home to me personally was the downside effect of having screening and then having the false positives have to be pursued in order to take care of any possibility of malignancy. And that's inherent almost in these screening tests, that there's going to be consequences, collateral downstream effects that have to be justified by a significant chance of prolonging your life. And it doesn't mean that every once in a while we're going to hit some home run and somebody's going to have a lesion that is removed and it does prolong their lives. But how many others are going to wind up either with a false sense of security, false negatives, false positives, or having to go through procedures that they don't need? So, I mean, that's what the balance is. And it's a risk-benefit ratio, if you will, of doing the screening or not doing the screening, and it depends on which cancer we're looking for. In a whole body scan, examining the lung is results that are too sensitive, too many false positives, and in the rest of the body, too many false negatives. Nothing is unanimous in professions and in medicine, as you know, but it's as close to unanimous as you could get that full body scans are not, we don't recommend them to anybody. We will do them under rare circumstances, but we don't think they should be done in the general population or should be marketed to people.
So the radiologists don't recommend full-body scans, despite how good the images are. Part of that hesitation is that the pictures need to be interpreted, and there's art as well as science to interpretation.
The public has to realize that if you do a very sophisticated, highly sensitive CT scan, they don't come out of the machine with an answer on them. There is a certain amount of equivocation. We have done lot of studies about accuracy, and we do expect to have, like in mammography, we expect to have 5 or 6% variation in how these images are interpreted. And we keep saying this all the time, you know, we all know that we miss stuff. And the whole goal of a strong specialty is to minimize those. And there's a lot of effort that's put into that. But I don't know of any place or any individual that's approached zero in terms of errors.
And what's true of radiologists is also true of pathologists who study the tissue and cells themselves. I've been reading a book by Dr. Gilbert Welch called Should I Be Tested for Cancer? Maybe Not, and Here's Why. He wrote it while he was a visiting scientist at the International Agency for Research on Cancer. I was surprised to learn that what looks like cancer in the eyes of one pathologist may not be cancer at all in the eyes of another. Cancer is in the eye of the beholder?
Pathologists don't disagree about cancers that you can hold in your hand, that the surgeon can feel and has to work hard to cut out. You know, a big cancer, you know, 100 out of 100 pathologists will look at that under the microscope and agree it's cancer. The time they disagree is when you get into really subtle forms of disease, and that's exactly what you're doing when you're looking for early forms of cancer. Perhaps I can make an analogy, and your listeners are probably from Canada, right?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe this won't work, but if you imagine looking at a United States map, and you're looking at the state of Utah on that map, how many lakes will you see? You'll only see one. It's the Great Salt Lake, and you can see it on a map of the United States. But if you zoom in and look at the state as a whole, you'll see three lakes. You'll see Utah Lake to the south, and you'll see Bear Lake up near the Idaho border. Those are two, not quite as big as the Great Salt Lake, but they're still good-sized lakes. But now you zoom in more, and you get into the mountain ranges of the Uinta, and you see thousands of lakes, really small lakes. So if you really look hard, you find a lot of lakes. They're small, and all of a sudden there'll be a debate. What constitutes a lake? How big does it have to be? And that's exactly what's happening to both the pathologists and the radiologists. They're zooming in more and more, looking for earlier and earlier forms. They're finding smaller and smaller things, and it's not surprising they're going to argue about exactly what constitutes a lake.
So should I be tested for cancer? Despite his cautionary tales, which provides some balance against the numerous pro-screening messages out there, Dr. Welch is not going to give a definitive answer.
My message isn't never get tested for early forms of cancer. Some people may choose to do that. They may still choose to do it, but at least they go into it with open eyes. And it really comes down to a set of value judgments of how you trade off the potential that you might be helped against the potential that you might be both made to worry needlessly and the less common, but nonetheless perhaps more concerning, that you might be treated needlessly. And at the same time, I should be frank, I don't want to scare them so much. I'm always fearful that I'm telling them never to see their doctors, and I have to remind them, you know, I think medicine's a good thing. I'm a conventionally trained American physician. If you're sick, see your physician. The question is what to do when you're well.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 137, and around the world on cbc.ca. I'm Paul Kennedy. Our program is called You Are Pre-Diseased with health researcher Alan Castles, who's at the world's largest medical meeting in Chicago, Illinois.
So to recap here quickly, the key benefits that Imaging Console provides to radiologists: quick and easy searching, answers to thousands of questions on diagnostic and procedural topics, the ability to download images for various uses, access to detailed diagnostic
images. That may be a key reason for our attraction to all these gadgets. This place is all about pictures. It's an art gallery of the human body in all its 3D or 4D radiation-enhanced glory. We humans just love pictures. and we believe in them. Dr. Brian Lenthal recognizes that appeal.
I think images are extremely powerful. The 20th century was sometimes called the century of the image because images became such a large part of our life. I mean, everything from the photographs of celebrities to movies, right up to and including medical imaging. Yeah, if I were to come back here in 50 years and look again at this, I think it'll be different. There is an increasing emphasis being placed on measurement and numbers, quantities, because after all, fundamentally, that's essential to science.
Blurring in their images because of patients' breathing. And this is a way to really manage the motion in patients because you're nervous to miss any small lesion that you might just say, oh, there's nothing there.
This well, important step toward the future. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
Yes, this conference is about the science of medical technology. But it's also clear to me there's a ton of money to be made and spent in this business. It has the tangy reek of commercialism that you often smell when disease prevention is being marketed. So I wonder, what happens to the poor unsuspecting consumer in all of this? Like the people back in my hometown of Victoria, who've been offered the chance to plunk down $500 for a body scan that can save your life. What messages are we taking in, and how are they affecting our ability to make these rather nuanced health decisions? Doctors Steve Wolishin and Lisa Schwartz have published extensively about health messages that reach the public, and are probably the world's authorities on what the public does and doesn't know about the subject of screening. I showed them the ad that I got from my local paper.
A body scan can save your life. This is the ad that lets consumers choose between a bunch of different kinds of ultrasound scans. And the claim is experts agree most heart disease, strokes, and cancer can be prevented if detected early. It's a crazy ad because these scans will find these things, so it's not preventing them. You're not preventing anything. Perhaps what they meant was that these scans can prevent death from those conditions, but there's no credible evidence that these kinds of scans prevent death from any of these things, with the exception of a subset of the population. There's one scan for abdominal aneurysms, but otherwise these scans for the gallbladder, the liver, a kidney, thyroid, and so on, no professional organizations recommend doing these things, and the reason is there's no credible evidence that they do more good than harm, and there's lots of reasons to think they may do more harm than good.
And in fact, one of the tests, the thyroid scan, which is included in the whole body scan, is a test where when people are training to do scans, they're actually told, do not look at the thyroid gland, because there are so many abnormalities to be found in the thyroid gland. And we know that once we start looking, we're going to find many of them. But on the other hand, we know that thyroid cancer is a very rare disease to die from. And so we know that most of these abnormalities should not be found and actually will be harming people by finding them. So in fact, some of these tests are clearly harmful, not just not helpful, but potentially harmful. An older message that I think really illustrates a crazy message is when the American Cancer Society began its campaign to encourage women to have breast cancer screening, their message was women who don't get mammograms need more than their breast examined. And so here, I mean, it's only an insane woman who would forego having mammography. And this is telling people that there is no choice. There's no genuine choice here, that if you're rational, that you can and you should have this test.
Tell me, why would the American Cancer Society have to resort to such a condescending message?
Well, I mean, I think there's this sense about cancer screening that, you know, we have something that can work against a terrible disease. And I think some of it is about this well-meaning effort to try to get people to do the right thing. And so once we have enthusiasm for this test and we have some evidence that it works, I think there's this sense that by any means necessary, we need to get people to do this test, and that there's lots of psychological theories about, you know, the way to get people to do something is to, you know, really emotionally engage them. Sometimes it's with fear, or I'm not sure why the condescension here, but, you know, to really engage them and then to give them some action to take.
It's not just the American Cancer Society. This is a common tactic. Every year, flu season, we hear messages about how, you know, the number changes, but sometimes it's 20,000 people die in the United States every year, 36,000, and sometimes, and you don't want to be one of them, get the flu shot. But, you know, there's no actually evidence that the flu shot prevents deaths from the flu. There may be other reasons that you might want to get it, but that's an example of a campaign that's using fear and sort of distorting data to get people to do what the people who are generating the message want them to do. These people think that everyone should get a flu shot. And so they're using, as Lisa said, any means necessary to get them by using a manipulative, persuasive message rather than informing people so that they can make decisions that are right for themselves.
So who benefits from having this kind of fear mongering, if you want to call it that?
Yeah. Well, it depends. I mean, sometimes, you know, industry-based ads that are trying to persuade people to do something clearly have someone who benefits, right, the manufacturer of the resource. These public health announcements, it's less clear who directly benefits. I mean, I think a lot of times it's the true believer, the people who, you know, who are involved in that aspect of public health work may just be true believers that this thing really works and that they have to, you know, convince everyone to do it. It's hard to know, but what seems to be consistent across lots of different domains is this idea that instead of helping people make a decision that's right for themselves, you know, an informative message, for whatever reason, lots of organizations decide to use these persuasive messages to get people to do what they think is right for them.
In 2000, Lisa Schwartz and Steve Wolishin published a study in the British Medical Journal about public attitudes towards medical screening. Why did they do it? And what did they find?
Well, the reason why we wanted to do this study was to understand what the effect of these public health messages are and how that may create an environment that's really right for the dissemination of any test that uses the same message, which is earlier is better and you're a good person if you start looking for disease early. So what we did was a national telephone survey with 500 adults from across the United States. We interviewed in this study both men and women who were free of cancer and who were at the ages where cancer screening tests are recommended. So women 40 and older and men 50 and older. And then we asked them a bunch of questions. And one of the things that we learned was that Americans are incredibly enthusiastic about cancer screening. They thought it was almost always a good idea. And so much so that they would overrule a physician who recommended that they not get a particular screening test. Few could imagine a time when they would stop getting screened. And in fact, this enthusiasm wasn't dampened by having a false positive test result. So people who had had a false alarm and, let's say, a mammogram that showed an abnormality, but then after the biopsy was done, turned out not to be cancer. So in our survey, about 40% of people had had at least one false positive screening test. So it could have been a mammogram or it could have been a prostate cancer blood test. But even though half of these people describe that experience of the false positive as being extremely scary, and, you know, a substantial portion said it was the scariest time of their life, almost all of them were glad that they had had the test, because I think in the end, the reassurance of finding out that they hadn't had cancer after having been so scared about it was such a tremendous relief that they didn't see the false positive as a harmful experience, but in fact as a reassuring experience in the long-term view. And then what we found was we asked about, at the time, what was going on in our country, which was about total body CAT scans. There were many ads in the papers about total body CAT scans, despite the fact that this was a totally unproved technology. And what we found was that nearly three quarters of the American public said that they would prefer the scan to receiving $1,000 in cash, even though there is absolutely no data to support its benefit or its safety, and no professional organization at the time recommended its use. And it was, in fact, actively discouraged by the American College of Radiology. So there was tremendous enthusiasm for this new and unproven test.
So just to be clear, given a choice between having a full-body scan or $1,000, the majority of people are going to go for the screen, which is of dubious benefit and possibly harmful.
Yes, right. Exactly. This was, we did the survey at the time that was probably the peak enthusiasm about total body CT in our country. Oprah had undergone a total body CT, and she told her story on the show, and she had some calcifications, and there was a news story in USA Today, which is what had prompted Oprah to go, and then there were a number of ads and facilities that were doing these tests. And we, our survey was maybe a year after this idea about whole body CTs became popular.
Overhaul of medical testing in laboratories. Doctors say critical staff shortages.
October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
Wherever the health messages are coming from, they're powerful. This is something I come across in the world of pharmaceuticals all the time, the yawning gap between what people believe about a drug and what the evidence says. The problem is, there's very little good health information for patients to find out there. And there's a big difference between someone telling you what to do and someone giving you the information for you to make your own choices. Lisa Schwartz and Steve Wolishin have written a book called Know Your Chances, Understanding Health Statistics, which provides some answers.
If we're going to ask people to be informed, we need to have good messages that include the information that they need. In fact, we were asked to write an editorial for the British Medical Journal about that very issue, which is that these new recommendations were that women should be informed, but yet as part of the recommendations, there was really no summary table which put all that information together. And in our editorial, we put together a table with that information. But I think that that's an important point, which is that we can't just tell people they need this information. We need to be providing it to them in a meaningful way.
We need to provide it in a meaningful way, but also part, one of the things we say in the book is we sort of alert people to what kind of information they need. And so if someone is recommending a treatment or a test or a drug, then it's incumbent on the person who's suggesting that treatment or intervention to provide the information. And if they can't provide it and they can't show the person where to go to get it, then that's a reason for the person to be maybe a little less enthusiastic about the recommendation.
Right.
But it's true, there's a lot of work that needs, I mean, it's easier to diagnose the problem. Sure. This is true in medicine in general. It's easier to diagnose the problem than to cure it. And, you know, we and lots of people have pointed out a lot of the limitations in the information that people get. And the real challenge now is figuring out how to get people quality information.
In a recent Pew Research study on health coverage in the U.S. media, it was announced that news about health occupied 3.6% of news during 2007 and the first half of 2008. A study from Simon Fraser University published in the May 2007 issue of the journal Social Science and Medicine found that simplistic, sensational stories on healthcare management far outnumber those that explore the major factors affecting people's health. The good news is that there are more and more books and websites available for the public, some general and some disease-specific. Among the physicians who have undertaken to help us inform ourselves is Dr. Norton Hadler, whose most recent book is entitled Worried Sick, A Prescription for Health in an Overtreated America. Dr. Hadler urges me to discuss it with my doctor when a screening test is suggested.
I need you to ask the question, how meaningful a result is this for me? By the way, I introduced the PSA conversation by the paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which is a famous paper written by a physician who, when this physician was in training, documented in the chart that he had a lengthy discussion with his patient about the marginal benefits of a PSA screen, and the patient opted not to have the PSA screen. And this physician finished training and went into practice, and lo and behold, that individual developed metastatic prostate cancer early on and died, and there was a lawsuit. And although the documentation was not at issue, that in fact the physician had explained all this and the patient had opted out of the PSA screening, The court found in favor of the patient's family in this lawsuit, the argument being that PSA screening is common practice. This physician who was giving rational advice and supporting a rational set of decisions was malpracticing. So if that's the societal construct, we need to make this very clear.
It seems to me atrocious that a well-meaning, thoughtful, rational physician would do things because of the fear of a lawsuit.
It's sad. What I will tell you that's encouraging in this regard is about 50 of the United States now have what are called science courts. And it was a big debate in the legal community as to whether such should be established, because the usual notion of a judge, a finder of fact, is that the judge need not have a tremendous amount of prior information, that the role of the finder, of the judge, is to sort of be an empty vessel, and you pour into the vessel all of the relevant information, and you shake the vessel, and a wisdom will come out, some judgment. Well, that may have worked in the past, but it's very hard to do that with an awful lot of high technology events. If this is a Microsoft patent case, there's no English being spoken. It's all jargon. And the same thing's true for a lot of modern medicine. So the judiciary in many of the states now have established science courts and assigned senior judges to sit on those courts. And because of that, there are judges' medical schools. And I've had the privilege of teaching in several. And we actually did a mock 3-day seminar, starting from the very basic science to the judicial judgment on missed breast cancer on a mammogram. And I think that kind of exercise, where the discussion about how one goes about thinking through the way science informs a screening modality, is now very much part of the discussion in the judiciary of a number of states. And we will be changing this malpractice climate because this discussion is changing the way people understand what this is all about.
So that seems to me a very positive evolution, where in the past physicians would do things through fear of a lawsuit. Now more rational minds are saying that doesn't need to be in place.
Well, it needs to be an informed debate. Screening was not the 11th commandment. It did not come down from Mount Sinai. Much of what we do in medicine were not on the tablets. We are in a new time for the interface of science and medicine, for the interface of science and the law. And it is important that we have public debates. Otherwise, what will happen is that people will assume that just because it is offered and insured, that this makes sense. And if it doesn't happen when it's insured and offered, I am being poorly served. In fact, people have to learn to ask questions about how meaningful is this for me as an individual.
Physicians also need to be kept aware of the latest science. The short time for interaction with patients and the lack of support for a patient-centered team approach to medical education has Dr. Norton Hadler worried for his country and warning Canadians.
I do a tremendous number of visiting professorships and have probably lectured at every Canadian medical school, or most of them, and have lived in London for a couple of years and in Paris for a long time and set up a teaching program in Japan and done such in Israel. I know a fair amount about medical education internationally, and my country is lagging far behind what's going on elsewhere. We have a very entrenched institution of medicine here that is enslaved to a business model that has to do with cash flow. I actually find the Socratic method of teaching at the bedside in desperate straits across my country. There are very few references in the charts. The name of the game is to get patients in and out in a hurry, particularly for procedures that are lucrative. So we are in trouble in my country. You are far less in trouble in Canada. Please don't follow us.
I still have this ad in my hand. A body scan can save your life. It's clear from everything I've heard that the best thing I can do with it is recycle the paper. After all, the clinic that offers a scan isn't like my family doctor. They don't know me. They have no record of my medical history or my risk factors for a particular disease. And they will not be responsible for fixing anything they might find. For a common sense view, I go back to talk to Dr. Gilbert Welch, who works at Dartmouth Medical School in Vermont and is currently on sabbatical in Montana. He's working on a new, as yet untitled book about overdiagnosis, the fact that the way medicine is practiced, we get far too many diagnoses of disease without substantive improvements in patient care. He uses an analogy that captures the gestalt of the time in a world where it seems, more and more, overdiagnosis is becoming the norm, where everyone is more or less pre-diseased.
I think this sort of generic problem is somewhat like the check engine lights on your car. I don't know, does your car have any check engine
lights? Yes.
I was thinking back when I started thinking about this that my first car was a 65 Ford Fairlane, and I think there's only two things being monitored, my oil pressure and my engine temperature.
Right.
I now drive a Volvo that's 10 years old, but it's checking about 25 different engine functions. Now, sometimes a check engine light comes on and it tells you something you're really glad to know, and it leads to something that you want to do something about. But I'm sure everyone in the audience has had some experience with a check engine light that's just been a nuisance, and it just keeps flashing on and off, and the garage guy can't fix it and this kind of thing. And some of your audience may have also had the somewhat rarer experience, but it led to a repair that actually made matters worse. And if you've had that experience, you have some of the experience of overdiagnosis, and that's what I'm worried about. We're putting more and more check engine lights on the human body, and we have to begin to ask ourselves if that's really the best way to get to a healthy society, is to be sort of constantly monitoring for things to be wrong. Is that really the best way to achieve health?
On Ideas, you've been listening to part two of You Are Pre-Diseased, prepared and presented by Alan Castles. For further information about all of the books, organizations, and people mentioned in the program, visit our website at cbc.ca/ideas. The program was produced in Vancouver by Kathleen Flaherty. Technical production, Chris Cutress. Special thanks to Jacqueline Van Wiltenberg. To find out about upcoming Ideas programs and podcasts, sign up for our weekly online newsletter. Just go to our website at cbc.ca/ideas and follow the links. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht, and I'm Paul Kennedy.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.